very fortunate to have a panel focusing, you know, after much discussion about an overview and the role of international organizations and bilateral cooperation. I think the issue of civil society has come up a number of times in the conversation, and we'll have a panel now looking very critically at the role that civil society organizations can play in conducting investigation, doing public education campaigns, and working to address the issues of the variety of different forms of trafficking in the region. And I'll turn it over to David Holliday from the Open Society Institute. Thank you.
I think I'll stay down here to introduce our speakers. My name is David Holliday from the Open Society Institute's Latin America program. And this panel on civil society, I'm looking forward to. It's something that concerns us a lot because we've been looking around and trying to figure out how to engage civil society on the issue of organized crime, which by definition seems to be the purvey either of institutions or the criminals themselves. So I hope at the end of two presentations, not three, that people will have some other ideas, hopefully, about what could be done from the civil society side. I'll just introduce the speakers briefly. You have their bios, and mention that the third speaker, Edith Zavala, could not be here today. I think we can thank two people principally, President Manuel Zelaya for kind of showing up unexpectedly in Honduras, and then de facto President Roberto Micheletti for, you know, clamping down and closing the airports, which I understand just opened again today, but it's too late to fly her up for this afternoon's panel. So anyway, she would have added a different element because she works on issues of migration in the region, and I think the sort of the overlay between migration and trafficking and smuggling is quite important. So the first panelist will be Marta Prado from Humane Society International. And she's the executive director for International Trade and Development. Humane Society International works on animal protection, and as you can see, her presentation is entitled Combating Illegal Wildlife Trafficking in Central America. The second speaker is Javier Melendez, who I think it's fair to say is one of the only people in Central America who's thinking seriously about issues of organized crime. And so I'm very much looking forward to his thoughts as well. Marta. They'll each speak for 15 minutes, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, and I wanted to thank CSIS for the opportunity to be here today. As David mentioned, I am with Humane Society International. Just so everybody knows who we are a nonprofit organization. We are the international arm of the Humane Society of the United States, which was founded in 1954, and we currently have a constituency of about 11 million people worldwide. As was mentioned, our mission is protection of all animals. We are headquartered here in Washington, D.C., and we have offices in different places throughout the world, including Canada, India, Europe, Australia, and Latin America. With respect to Latin America, I should also mention that we work on both policy and programs. We believe that to affect policy change, it also helps work on programs. So we work on a variety of issues, anything from wildlife and habitat protection, marine mammals. We work with farm animals. We do sustainable agriculture. We also do domestic animals. In Latin America, we do a lot of street animal welfare. As many of you know, there's a lot of stray animals in Latin America. And we also, tied to wildlife protection, we also have one of our strongest programs is on CITES implementation, which I'm going to be talking about today. And we've been working on CITES in Central America and the Dominican Republic, and the reason for that is because of the trade agreement that the United States has with Central America and the Dominican Republic, where there's an environment chapter. Countries have to effectively enforce their environmental laws. And there's an accompanying environmental cooperation agreement, which allows for different programs and policies to work with the countries to implement those. Since 2006, we've been collaborating with the U.S. State Department, along with the Department of Interior and with Traffic, with Adrian Reuter, who you heard today. And we also work directly with the different government authorities in each of the countries, ministries of agriculture, environment, customs, et cetera. We also work with local NGOs. We really believe that partnering with local NGOs and building the capacity of local NGOs is very important. These are just the countries that we work on, and I guess just to reemphasize, these countries are very important from a wildlife perspective because of the high biodiversity in the countries. Again, just repeating some of the common themes that you've heard earlier from Adrian and from Juan Carlos. In Central America, there's a high demand for wildlife for various reasons. Sometimes they're to serve as pets, animals such as parrots, macaws, spider monkeys. There's also a demand in certain areas for reptile meat, iguanas. For example, in Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, they use the meat. There's also an international market, which has been mentioned, primarily in the United States, Europe, Asia, and also increasingly in the Caribbean countries. And just to mention, because this conference does focus on the linkages, there are some linkages in some of the routes for drug and wildlife trafficking. For example, in conversations with Guatemalan officials, they indicate that the route from Petén through to Mexico and then to the United States has been used for both drugs and wildlife trafficking. Honduras is another example, this one more on the Atlantic coast, going up through La Ceiba out to the Bay Islands and from there to the Caribbean and the U.S. These are just some of the commonly trafficked wildlife in Central America. You have the white-fronted parrot, a lot of times used for pets. You have crocodiles, more for the international market for the skins. You have iguanas, as I mentioned, for meat. And you have macaws, which are both for the regional and for the international market as pets. Just identifying some of the current gaps in wildlife trafficking, and some of this, I think, can be applied in other areas that we're discussing today. There's a lack of training for inspection personnel. The same customs officials are responsible for all sorts of illegal activity, trafficking, et cetera. There's a failure to enforce laws. I think that it's been mentioned that these countries, a lot of times, have laws, but they're not enforced, and the penalties aren't enforced. So, for example, you'll have someone seize a confiscated animal from someone, and then nothing is really done to follow up on that. So that's an issue. Something which I'll talk more about today is that there's insufficient wildlife rescue centers. You know, you confiscate an animal, and then the animal has to go somewhere. There's a lot of animals that are confiscated, not enough places to take them. There's a high demand, as I mentioned, for tropical wildlife in people's homes, and there's also high instances of poverty and lack of alternative sources of income. Because of the different challenges, our program has four different areas. One, which has been mentioned several times for the various areas, is training. Training for government officials who work on CITES, also training for non-governmental organizations that work with the government, and also from our perspective, basic animal handling techniques. You have customs officials at the border that, you know, if they are faced with a snake, They don't want to handle it. So we have to teach them how to properly handle and take care of the animal. With wildlife rescue centers, we're supporting through capacity building, infrastructure development for them. We're also working a lot in public outreach campaigns, and I think this is very important to reduce the demand for the products, both at the domestic and the regional level. And finally, working on ecotourism as an economic alternative to illegal poaching that takes place in many rural communities. With respect to the trainings, we've been doing a variety of trainings for many years. Just as examples, in the past year, one of the issues that has been faced is improper transport. For the animals. So we worked with the International Air and Transport Association on a regional workshop for these countries. We also conducted binational workshops at border areas. Again, you know, there's been a lot of discussion today about the different border posts, et cetera. We've been working at a binational level because a lot of times the countries are not talking to one another. So, for example, we did a workshop in El Castillo, which is on the border between Costa Rica and Nicaragua. We did another one on the border with Honduras and El Salvador. And for these workshops, they're a basic introduction to CITES and the national implementation of the laws. A lot of officials don't really know anything about CITES, for example, and as I mentioned, animal handling techniques for the animal seizure process. And these are just some examples of the workshops. We usually combine, we'll have presentations, we'll have group activities where we break people off so they can really actively participate, and then we have hands-on training for animal handling. And as I mentioned, you know, you have trainings, you have the officials that confiscate the animals, and then what? Go ahead. As has been mentioned, the smuggling methods that people use are horrible. You have a lot of animals that die in transit. For example, with parrots, you have up to 90% of the animals that die. Animals are concealed in luggage. They're drugged. They're concealed in their garments. They're hidden in shipment containers. So as you can imagine, when the officials receive the animals, they're not in great conditions. With respect to CITES, and again tying our program to the effective implementation of CITES, governments, there is a resolution 10.7 under CITES which deals with the disposition of confiscated live wildlife. Governments are tasked with the final disposition of animals, whether it's keeping them in captivity, reentering them into the wild, performing euthanasia, etc. Once the animals are confiscated, then they need to undergo a rigorous process of rescue and ultimate disposition. With respect to what we've been doing with wildlife rescue centers, as I mentioned, there's not enough centers and places in these countries to take animals. So what we've been doing is giving small grants to the rescue centers, and this can be anything from buying medicines, for example, helping build enclosures for quarantine, rehabilitation, and release, just small grants to help these centers out. We also had a best practices workshop where we brought different rescue centers from each of the countries in CAF to DR, as well as government officials, so that everybody could exchange information, coordinate, etc. We also provide technical assistance, and this can be anything from helping them with fundraising, volunteer programs, protocols for animal reception of these animals. And we're also doing a sustainability study to try and then come up with a plan in the future for how to make these rescue centers sustainable. These are just some of the examples that we have. For example, up there you have iguanas locating the appropriate place to release wildlife. You also want to make sure that you don't place wildlife in the wrong place, for example, and it'll be captured again, or it's just not in its habitat. Animal handling techniques. The bottom one is actually some infrastructure that we'd help with a Nicaraguan rescue center for pre-release sites for birds that are confiscated. As I mentioned, public outreach. That's something that we really believe is key, and that's everything from school children to tourists that come into the countries and don't know what they're buying. They see something in the store, they assume it's legal. Sometimes it's not. And also just creating public awareness in society in general. So we do anything from work with school children. For example, up there it's a bingo game that we've developed with some of the CITES listed species, and then we talk about the importance of them. Other times there's posters which highlight the criminal nature of the activity and talk about calling in to the governments if people see that animals are being trafficked illegally, etc. And as I mentioned, for this in this component, we always work with local NGOs. In these countries, there's a lot of technical expertise that the local NGOs have. They just don't have the funding to take these activities. These are just some of the examples. It runs from posters where it says, "If you love nature and its place," to a bingo card, to posters where we had school children do a competition where they drew things. The bottom is a poster where Honduras to turn in traffickers. And the one of the school children I always like, because they're very poor kids in Nicaragua that shoots birds with slingshots. And so we had them all trade their slingshots in, and they got backpacks and coloring books, etc. Finally, ecotourism as an economic alternative. It provides, this is important because it provides a profitable means to benefit from local wildlife without illegally extracting the fauna. Communities can earn 2 to 3 times as much income from wildlife viewing as from poaching. A lot of times the poachers are also the best tour guides because they know where the animals are. And finally, the financial benefits also encourage the communities themselves to self-police the areas that they live in and to drop the extraction rate of these animals. And then these are just some of the programs, pictures from the programs we have. And finally, recommendation. And I think these are just common themes that we've heard throughout the day. Coordination is key. And coordination is, you know, between governments, among government agencies, between the governments and non-governmental organizations. Sustainability is also important. There's a high level of turnover in the governments and customs, national police, et cetera. So really trying to be creative in training, et cetera. Increased funding for the CITES authorities and enforcement personnel. Ministries of Environment, for example, are notoriously receive some of the least amount of funding in these countries for something that's very important. Also, government funds contribute to rescue center expenses. Governments are responsible for the final disposition of the animals, as I mentioned, but the governments, with the exception of Guatemala, don't contribute to the expenses for the rescue centers. And finally, continued campaigns to reduce the demand for legal trafficked wildlife. And then just in keeping with the recommendations I just made, some of the things that we're looking to do in the future coming up, the CITES Secretariat has worked on a CD to institutionalize for CITES in general. We're working on an animal handling CD component that will accompany that so that customs officials will always have something to help them as they're learning how to handle animals. Encouragement of wildlife rescue centers, as I mentioned, the sustainability part. Continued campaigns working with local NGOs and the continued promotion of ecotourism. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marta. Okay, almost 15 minutes, right on the dot. Javier.
Okay, gracias a los que han tenido la paciencia.
Thank you to those who've had the patience to listen. It's a problem because when you talk about civil society, everyone takes off running because they think there's not a lot of importance to do and nothing important to do in this area, and it's to the contrary. I work for a center that's called the Institute for Strategic Studies and Public Policy, which was created 5 years ago when I spent a couple of years here in Washington. And with 3 colleagues, we have to create, we said, this type of think tanks like we have in Washington in Central America. And we were able to establish this institution, which now is a very important point of reference in Nicaragua for Central America with reference to security. And we did this in order to do advocacy with regard to security and national defense. Now we're going on our 5th year of existence. And I would like to, in a context, talk about the context in which we need to work. First of all, in Central America, the number of research centers which are dedicated to working on security are very scarce, and when they exist, they have projects and not programs. If you look at a map, the NGOs, you might work with one for a short while on police reform in Nicaragua or Honduras, but then it ends in a year or so, and there's no continuity. What we've attempted to do is to use security as our driving force, and then everyone needs to remember why we began our organization. We have very little access to public information, and I'm trying to explain the context that we're working in. There are a lot of restrictions, and security matters are usually kept secret. You can imagine that in a research project from a research center or an academic organization, it's very complex, and the intangibles that arise make us extend our deadlines and for any type of report we want to prepare. The research centers can do many things. We can generate information and, above all, independent information. we can be a point of reference for comparing the official versions of what's going on and with independent ones, which arise through the analysis that we carry out regionally, locally, and nationally. Also, it has to do with promoting dialogue with private sector and in meetings like this. It's a point of reference. It's very pleasing to us to have had in last month 4 or 5 meetings of think tanks and networks that will work more strongly on subjects regarding organized crime, and also to organize and put forth different exchange networks that can take place in Central America between us, Mexico, and the U.S. Working on organized crime, we have, since 2007, developed a very strong area of work between on drug trafficking and human trafficking. We're working with funds from USAID, and in the State Department, funds were cut back strongly, and David has helped with the Open Society Institute, and with this we were able to carry out different activities, research activities. Since June of 2008, we are running a program focused in Panama, on Panama, Nicaragua, and another country, and you may have seen some reference material in this regard. We would like to progress. I'd like to tell you about some of the findings that we have come up with regard to organized crime in these countries. I'd like to emphasize that we are doing work in the field that's extremely intense, and we're going to the border of the countries, visiting the border of Panama and Colombia, Costa Rica and Panama, Nicaragua and Costa Rica. It's a very intensive effort, and we've mobilized considerably. And some of our findings are that in general, in Costa Rica, Panama, and Nicaragua, we have not visualized connections or links between drug trafficking and human trafficking. And here, with the Interpol representative, we need to begin to see how this evidence makes sense. There's very specific human trafficking and very specific trafficking groups that are doing drug trafficking. Essentially speaking of Panama, Costa Rica, and Nicaragua. Human trafficking, in traffic in general, we've determined that the structures of the local networks are very complex and broad. It's not true that organized crime and trafficking is transnational. It indeed is a matter that is, it's not a monopoly run by the gangs in our area. There's a strong group linked, they are strongly linked with drug trafficking. We've noted as well through our travels that in these three countries, above all in Panama and Nicaragua, there are very large groups. I'm not sure how you would translate it in English, but they're community groups, whether they're organized or not, who essentially take over what the boats bring from Colombia for the drug traffickers, or they rob these groups. They steal their drug shipments. And what does this mean? This has brought up two important phenomena. One would be a high level of violence. We have noted in Panama where a group of Cunayala captured a shipment of hundreds of kilos of cocaine from a Colombian group, and they distributed it in different networks of the indigenous communities in Panama. The next week, the Colombians came and took over the did not kill people, but they burned the community and their animals and their crops as a warning that this is something that should not be repeated. But unfortunately, this is being repeated. We have noted that there's we can do an ethnic study of organized crime. Depending on the leadership among the indigenous communities, the activity with regard to organized crime is accepted in some cases in the community, like in Panama, like the Imbera, where the chief of the group accepts that there can be a service provided of the indigenous people to the drug traffickers. But there are other cases where the chief rejects this completely. In the first case, the indigenous person had to provide a certain percentage of the money to the community, and it's used by the community, and the rest is authorized to be utilized as this person sees most fit. So this is emphasizing the fact that in the border communities, there's a strong level of social breakdown. The silent effects of drug trafficking becomes evident, and there we are seeing a generation of violence along the border, especially between Nicaragua and Costa Rica and some parts of the Caribbean in Costa Rica. Another phenomenon we've observed is that there are low levels of violence, with the exception of the places I mentioned in the southeast of Nicaragua. We're noting that there's a presence of hitmen, in which more and more there are local bands stealing drugs from the drug traffickers, and those bands, unfortunately, are made up principally of former police officers. So what's happening is that the cartels of Mexico or the hitmen are coming, and they're beginning to exterminate these people who have stolen drugs from the cartels. With regard to information about human trafficking and weapons trafficking, there's very little information about this. The production is focusing on human trafficking for sexual purposes, and I believe that it's not that there's so little information, but we need to understand that the subject of organized crime is very corporate organized. It's monopolized by corporations. And which ones are they? The police, the prosecutor's office, the public defender's offices, and it's not democratic. It's very complicated. And this limits our ability to gather evidence that would let us know what's really going on in this situation. But we're attempting to work very hard at building in the three countries the greatest detail possible the characteristics of human and arms trafficking. And we're trying to understand the dimension they have and the vulnerability that exists in the population. There's very little human development. This is a focus that requires more work. If you see a map of poverty in Latin America, you'll notice it's along the borders. In Costa Rica, for example, the main poverty areas are in their border with Panama. Several towns are involved that have the lowest development level in Costa Rica. And it's a situation which we see replicated in the border areas of Nicaragua and Honduras and Costa Rica, and not to mention Panama and Colombia, that border area where you see the greatest pocket of poverty in the countries. Also, I'd like to mention, with regard to human trafficking, there's a high level of this intercontinentally speaking, but I won't go into depth on this because I think other panelists have covered it very well. As you can see on the map, we have been walking all around all these areas. We've gone by land, we've gone by boat, and it's not easy, especially in Panama. We had an experience where we had a Mexican researcher. We brought in Mexico as well into the dialogue with him, and we had also a Colombian who was advising us, a specialist on security on a local level, and it's not easy. We were walking along the border with Colombia, a Mexican, a Colombian, and a Nicaraguan, and when we landed in the plane, we were only a few kilometers from Colombia, and right away the border guard was waiting for us, and it was extremely complicated to do our research because we were administered by them, obviously. Our focus, essentially, with regard to security, is there are professionals here from civil society, NGOs, and what we're trying to do is reproduce the good practices that are done in other countries. Remember that we're a research center, we're an NGO, but our work is to produce information and to do this so that information is provided to make decisions to democratize security issues or information on security. We have had some gaps with regard to, sorry, but the slide's going a little slowly. I referred to them previously. We have serious problems in accessing information. For example, it was impossible for people from DEA to take care, to help us in the different countries, and people from the Department of Justice accredited in the embassy of the U.S. do not answer our emails, and so it's very difficult. Police work secretively. We've had to work with very off-the-record sources, with a lot of formal officers of security forces, and in reality, there are problems that within international cooperation, from international agencies and national agencies, the work of civil society is undermined considerably. I think that from civil society we can begin to work and improve the framework for analysis, and we can continue to reinforce the evidence provided. It's a strong component of information. We work with a lot of journalists. The researcher in Panama is a former journalist, and another worked for 16 years in Nicaragua working as a correspondent. So these people provide a tremendous assistance in processing evidence and information. We have some recommendations for improving government, civil society, and international organization coordination in addressing this problem. The government, I believe, is highly focused on teamwork, terminology. It's not the problem of organized crime is affecting border communities that are very poor, and as a result, we need to direct public policy towards human development in these areas. We need to improve civil bureaucracy, which is in very available in a small way in Central America, and there's very little oversight in society and political control. And also, there's a tendency to be so secret about things. Civil society, as I mentioned, but also I'd like to add that we need to approach those who make decisions, and in particular, we make a very huge effort, a lot of investment in time and resources to bring our results, our findings to those who make decisions on a legislative level and the executive branch also. I'd like to clarify and make a parenthesis. In Nicaragua, being independent and being a civil society organization is very sensitive. We have a lot of government pressure, and so we focus more on the legislative branch. And to finalize, the international organizations that will coordinate more, we have two important supports, the U.S. through Commando Southern Command, and also, the agency in charge of following drug trafficking matters spends $60 million per year. And in other areas, a huge amount is spent. So we're focusing towards human development. We're carrying out efforts in the communities along the border. And we need to define the frameworks for action. CICTA, which is a Central American integration initiative, which is slow, it's like a giant elephant. The processes are way too complex and slow. And within this framework, when the previous panelists mentioned the relationship with how organized crime moves and how the state moves, the integration system in Central America is a reflection of the institutional weakness of all the Central American countries. I think in the end, I'll finish here, and we need to understand that organized crime, first of all, remove the myth that Central American presidents, that it's a, as they sometimes say, it's a U.S. problem. Drug trafficking and organized crime is a Central American problem. There's evidence that more and more people are being paid for their efforts with drugs, and this increases the availability of drugs on a national basis and generates violence because to take over these local markets, which are paid for by for storage and distribution by local groups. If we don't focus on organized crime as a point of vulnerability in our society, and you know that we need to invest in human development, more police and teams as and equipment as is necessary, the problem will become even larger. First of all, a deputy prosecutor said that we're actually, we look silly next to organized crime when we, in Costa Rica, when we look at their organization, work in fields, in the field, and do questions, the service that is being provided has 23 motorcycles and 12 pickup trucks to handle this entire border between Costa Rica and Panama. And under these conditions, it's so serious. What we can expect in the future with regard to organized crime is serious. Thank you.
So those are two very different presentations, but I hope there's some discussion. Feel free to also make comments and have a dialogue here. And I would, as I said before, I'd be very interested to know if people have other ideas about ways that civil society can be involved in this issue. So the floor is open. Please introduce yourself prior to asking a question. There's one back there. I can see this question has stumped you all as well. What does civil society do?
Well, actually, I'm Peter Harrell. I'm from the State Department, the Secretary's Policy Office. And actually, David, that was my question that I wanted to ask the panelists. You know, how have you seen, what kinds of, you both talked quite a bit about providing information and doing research. How have you found it effective for civil society to actually engage communities in the fight against trafficking of these different kinds?
Actually, the hardest part of our job has been to include civil society at the community level. There is fear and of the authorities due to corruption, not only at the highest level, but also at the base. And I was struck about Jaque, a village close to Colombia, 2 or 3 hours away, 2,000 people and 23 bars. There is something going on. They are being supplied with international liquor. There's a problem, but the community does not want to engage in dialogue. Our challenge is based on the findings to generate a practical and methodological process that allows us to encourage the border communities to intervene on this phenomenon that is rottening the fabric of society. There is logistics support of drugs that are coming from the Caribbean. We've seen this in Nicaragua. We see the Emberan and Conayala's role in Costa Rica, in the Caribbean, there is evidence of participation by the campesinos in the domestic production of marijuana and storing of drugs. So we have to participate with the communities and bring approaches that have been proven to be reliable. We're working with Colombian experts to develop methods to reinforce community participation and security.
To that, working with communities can be difficult. One of the ways that we've done it is working with local communities, local NGOs that work in protected areas, near protected areas, on ecotourism. So it's an economic alternative where they actually make a better income protecting the animals in their communities than poaching. So that's one of the ways that we've been doing it. The other way, I think, is just more of a long-term solution is in our work that we do with school children, with schools, with materials on wildlife protection. I mentioned one of the events that we had where all the little kids with the slingshots came in to trade them in. So it's more of a long-term, but while adults, for example, may be more difficult to reach, you know, if you reach the younger children, long-term we think that will have an effect.
Thank you. My name is Cynthia Pereira, and I'm with the U.S. Department of the Interior here in Washington. A question for both of you. How do you think you can get the NGOs or civil society and the law enforcement agencies to better engage and better work with each other?
Es una de las partes más difíciles.
This is one of the hardest things to attain. In Central America, there is no culture wherein the public official understands accountability and be monitored by the taxpayer. If we translate this to the security forces, that's even worse. The military and police force in Central America act very autonomously. The civilian bureaucracy that control them is very weak. And what I would recommend is to go back to what the Defense Department of the U.S. In the 90s did in Central America, to try to reorganize their institutions for monitoring and civilian control of the security forces. I used to be very fundamentalist about the participation of the armed forces in organized crime, but I've turned 40 recently and I have become more pragmatic, and I accept it. Because in Central America, we have not had the classical army that there is in other countries, more like a National Guard. There are 18,000 in Guatemala, 15,000 in Nicaragua. So this could be an important contribution. My point of view is how to do that. One of the requirements is that it has to be under the monitoring of civil society that is proven to be reliable and professional.
In the region in 2003, one of the very first workshops that we'd actually with the CITES Secretariat, where we invited local rescue centers, for example, there was no communication between the governments and the rescue centers, for example, the NGOs. Many times they didn't even know that they existed, even though the governments were supposed to be taking the animals to the rescue centers. So I think a lot of it from our perspective is just communication, bringing them together. There is a much better relationship now between the governments and the NGOs, at least that we've been working with, the rescue centers. It's not always perfect. I think part of it is coordination. Part of it, I think, is getting over the mistrust that each has over the other, government to NGO and vice versa. And I think that that can be overcome, you know, through meetings, communications constantly over time. So I think that's one of the ways that, at least in our work, that we've been dealing with that. And also, if, for example, in all the workshops that we have, we make it a point that we invite governments and we invite the local NGOs. And so they work together, and they'll work together on group exercises and trainings, and I think that that's helped.
Yo solo quiero agregar que
I wanted to add that monitoring of the public sector and the law enforcement is very rudimentary in Central America. This is something that has to be worked on, and the international agencies of cooperation should strengthen the role of the press through investigative journalism, the training of specialized journalists, and the collection of evidence for drug and wildlife trafficking. Secondly, it has to do with the civil society. I'd like to see programs that address security. If we do not train people, centers, and groups, the society does not have the ability to be more vigilant.
Our third speaker who was unable to come today was going to speak about the role of NGO networks or civil society networks and, you know, some of the, I guess, the pluses and, you know, perhaps some drawbacks of working through, you know, networks, you know, bringing together different NGOs in countries. I wonder if either of you have experience with being involved in any kind of a network and what some of the advantages of sort of different civil society groups working together might be.
Well, I think not so much. With our program work, we try and bring the groups together. There's not necessarily a network per se. I think in for example, in some of the policy work that we do, whether it's protection of whales or turtles or other things, there are Latin American networks, sometimes Central American networks, and I think that is very helpful on the wildlife side, just because many times these groups are very small, they have limited resources, and they'll have different expertise. You know, someone may have a biologist, another one may have an attorney, and, you know, there's just sometimes three or four people in each of these groups. So I think that working in networks can be a good thing. I think some of the challenges are always, you know, when you have more people working, you know, sometimes it's harder to come to agreement. For example, if you're putting together, you know, a paper or something like that, you know, in the same way interagency or you know, it happens everywhere. So I think you just have to take that into account. But I think that especially in areas like in developing countries, I think that the networks can be very important in highlighting the message and making it more effective.
I believe that the donors should reinforce the approach to support regional initiatives and networks. The Institute has to necessarily work on a platform. Central America does indeed have a great deal of experience in networking, especially around the prevention of youth violence, and it is very active. On security, we have a network, Red Cepas, Honduras, Guatemala, Costa Rica, the FESPAL Institute in El Salvador. We attempt to develop research on citizen security. Unfortunately, we are not articulated correctly, and there are too many leaders. We have a hard time relinquishing the national leadership to a regional agenda, but there is the support of a couple of groups of exchange, the Global Exchange on organized crime. We had a meeting in Mexico 3 weeks ago. I think it has a lot of academic promise. The consortium is gathering efforts throughout the continent to work on organized crime. Also, there is a forum with that met in Costa Rica last week with a group of analysts that are bringing a lot of new blood into the analysis of organized crime. The UNDP, local agencies, corporations, Interpol, police, they are beginning to understand and participate in these centers of exchange. We believe that we have to reach to different areas in order to gather more interest. I would suggest that you look at our website. There is a document, Security Outlook, that we update every 2 weeks, and we give an update of national security news. And you may see that in most countries, the news have to do with the brutal impact of organized crime activities. It cannot get any worse.
So it's clear for civil society to have any kind of role on this or any issue, they need access to information. And that's an issue that you, Javier, you've especially pointed out is lacking. And it does seem to me that in this particular issue, it's extremely difficult for governments to think about, to prioritize that as something valuable. On the one hand, you sort of want society to be involved and to be aware of these problems, but the tendency is just to announce when you have a success, when you've captured someone. And what you're left with, I think, is a very simplistic and not very sophisticated understanding about these phenomena, how things work. And so, yes, academics or journalists do the sort of the field work, and they come up with you get a lot more interesting information from them than you do from our own governments, who in theory should know most of this stuff, and I think many times do. So what is it, what kind of information in both of your areas of work, what kind of information would be beneficial for civil society to get from governments that would empower them to sort of take a more active role either in vigilancia and sort of oversight of what the government is doing or thinking about new policies or engaging in a dialogue?
A ver, yo voy a tratar de decir de que la
I'll try to tell you that the weakness and lack of information is not just because the official doesn't want to provide it. It has to do as well with the fact that there is a weakness in gathering and processing the information. Statistically speaking, Central Americans are very poor and deficient countries. And there is a matter with regard to technical assistance, the OAS, through an initiative which they will launch soon, will try to urge us forward to process and provide indexes on violence. In some cases, there isn't information. In some cases, it isn't one. They don't want to provide it. If the governments would just admit that they cannot generate the information because they don't have resources or capacity, then it would be a beginning point to discuss this. We can work together to create methodologies and processes that will allow these governments to improve their handling of information and be more effective in delivering the information. When a person doesn't want to provide the information or the government doesn't wish to, what we do is make known what we find and see the reaction. If we say that human trafficking is going along this A, B, and C routes, and the government has evidence that that's not the case, then they'll have to react and clarify the situation if it's A, B, and C, or B, C, and D. So there's a dynamic which is arising here where we are more active in provoking so that the government will respond and and they don't want to politically monopolize the information.
Side is a matter of not necessarily that the governments, as Javier mentioned, don't want to share the information. A lot of times they don't have it or they don't. Or, for example, let's say an animal is confiscated in a border post, you know, in El Castillo, Nicaragua. To get that information, let's say it's on paperwork, to get that to the capital, a lot of times it's impossible. There's not a computerized system in a lot of these countries in the capital, much less in these areas. So I think that's part of the problem, is that when you have confiscations, for example, they don't have it. Or it's a matter of, let's say, they do send all the paperwork to the capital, and then it's just like sitting in a room and no one has time. There's no resources to kind of input that all. And so I think that's part of the problem. And I know in some of the countries, they're starting to try and get it put together, a database with funding from international agencies, et cetera. But I think that's one of the biggest problems that we've seen.
I mean, maybe it's just impossible, because isn't there something inherent or intrinsic to government that you don't want to publicize all of the things that you can't control? I mean, what's the incentive? There's no electoral incentive. What's the political incentive? So we have a dilemma here where, yes, the government may have the information, or it doesn't have the information, or it doesn't collect it well, but those are not the kinds of things they want to talk about. That makes it all the more difficult to... and yet, if they don't talk about it, it's never going to get better either. So I don't know. Are there any more questions? Bob? Just one second.
Ciertamente Nicaragua.
Surely Nicaragua. Nicaragua, I'm trying at this time to make an analysis of the reason why Nicaraguan police are successful or were successful under very special conditions. It's a poor country like Nicaragua. I think that if we talk about good practices, there are good practices that we must take up again in Nicaragua. In Nicaragua, in reality, a deep reform was carried out in the security system. There was a political will to do this.
La policía de Nicaragua, después de los carabineros de Chile.
The carabineros in Chile, Latino Barometer carried out surveys of the citizens in Latin America, and the Nicaraguan army has one big problem, in my opinion, one big problem, and that is that they're mega business people, that it's the third or fourth largest financial holding in the country. Mendelssohn says, look at this on the good side, and he thinks this was part of the participation in peace operations. This was the cost that we had to pay in order for the military not to be actively involved in politics and stop doing business. So many officers and the national police nowadays are assessing the Guatemalan and Salvadorian and Honduran police with funds from Sweden and Finland. We need to take into account the fact that since 1990, Nicaragua had a very large movement of civil society through NGOs, and when the state moved back in providing diverse services in health and education, there was an active movement on the part of NGOs working heavily in the community and in the neighborhoods. And these NGOs work closely with the police, and in Nicaragua, the concept of community police has been highly successful. They have problems, of course, but it's been successful, and in reality, the concern is how to make this sustainable, because it's a good model among police in Latin America. Personally, as a Nicaraguan, I'm very proud.
To answer your question, have there been successes? Yes, I mean there's definitely an improvement in all of the countries. They're just in different areas, and each country has its strengths and weaknesses. And so, for example, Guatemala has very good laws with respect to rescue centers, for example, and the government has a very good relationship with a rescue center in Petén. El Salvador, with the help of U.S. State Department and Department of Interior, has new legislation in national legislation in the country, and points can be made for Nicaragua and Honduras as well. So there are successes in all of the countries. There's just a lot of work that needs to be done, just generally.
Just to comment on Javier, just to note that Javier is not someone who has a great relationship with the current government in Nicaragua. So when he says this, it's sort of, I think it's quite significant. Are there other questions? If not, Catherine, do you want to? Thank you very much, and let's just give a hand to our panelists.
Thank you to our last panelists, and actually I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking all the panelists and the moderators from today who came early this morning and made very, I think, insightful and provocative presentations. I also want to thank my colleagues in the Americas program for their help in organizing the conference itself and the logistics and the smooth running of the conference itself today. So thank you to all of you. What I wanted to announce just quickly is that we will place the presentations on the web as soon as they are available to upload. So you can look for those on our website in a couple of days, or if not, certainly within a week. We have also recorded the presentation today, so that's why we were going around with the microphone to make sure that we captured all of the comments as well. And so once that goes through some editing, we will place that on the web also. And finally, we will be putting together a summary of the analysis and the conclusions that were discussed and presented today, and that will be both circulated within the list here of the conference and within the Americas program, and also placed on the web. So you can look for that within a couple of months as well, within a couple of weeks on the web, and then we'll have a further version available in Spanish as well. So again, I want to thank all of you for coming and for participating, to thank all of our panelists and moderators. I want to thank the Open Society Institute for its support for this conference today, and very much appreciate your coming and spending part of your day here. So thank you.